I'll go ahead and get started here. So the reason for this diverse panel is it's something I saw General Petraeus do in 2007 when he was putting together a group of experts, and I wouldn't say we're experts up here, but this group that he was putting together around the table. He said, okay, I understand there's a lot you disagree with this Iraq policy. I challenge you to tell me not only what's wrong with it, but how to fix it, to make recommendations. So after speaking to my colleagues here on stage at different places, such as green rooms at Fox News, we talked about these things. And we decided, why don't we put a panel together? So this is looking at, and the reason I'm not a moderator is I actually want to get in the fight a little bit. So that's why I'm sitting on the panel. But I'll go ahead and throw it over to my colleague, Suzanne.
Thanks, Michael. So, right, he wanted to be on the panel, and therefore that's why we've come prepared with a yellow card and green card to keep it tame. I mean, a red card. Anyway, welcome to Trump's 110th day in office. And we're here to discuss his Middle East policy, which when we first put this panel together, the kind of initial reaction that I saw kind of on the interwebs and social media was, oh, what is Donald Trump's Middle East policy? Which is why we have this panel here to discuss it. You know, on the campaign trail, obviously, Mr. Trump had tough rhetoric on Iran, which we've seen consistency on that front. But he was less interested in getting involved in Syria, which we have seen the opposite of that. You know, if you think, what is Donald Trump's Middle East policy, the number one thing that we think of is the fact that he ordered a strike in retaliation for the chemical attack by Assad. So we have a lot to discuss, and we're just going to jump right in, starting with Syria. You know, Dave has a lot of experience with working with some of the Syrian opposition groups. Marie Harf was the deputy spokesperson in 2013, which was the last time there was a discussion about launching an airstrike on Assad, which, as we all remember, didn't happen, which we really want to get to the bottom of, Marie. And then, obviously, Michael has very strong views about this. So,
and everything else.
Good stuff.
President Trump's decision to order a strike on the airbase in early April, what are your thoughts on it? Go.
All right, so we'll start with the airstrikes. 59 cruise missiles the night of April 6th to finally do something about Assad's use of chemical weapons. And it was met with support from both sides of the aisle. There were people in the Obama administration that were frustrated that not more was done when Assad crossed the red line. And then everybody else should be frustrated all along that we've ignored Assad's use of conventional munitions and barrel bombs to punish a population center and kill a lot of civilians. So with Trump's strike in Syria, and which is really interesting, I'd really like for you to talk about the more robust package that you were able to look at in 2013. General McMaster presented Trump with an option. We can take out all six airfields or we can take out one airfield. Well, we attacked an airfield. We didn't necessarily take it out. So everybody was pretty happy about what happened. But let's look at what happened since then. Mm-hmm. Since then, Russia has put all of Assad's aircraft on Russian bases, protected with their S-400s. Since then, Russia, Iran, and Turkey have agreed to establish these safe zones, which are also no-fly zones for U.S. and coalition aircraft, which are also, in the case of Russia and Iran, protected killing zones for Assad and IRGC proxies on the ground, using Russian aircraft and using Assad's air force as the air component, and the ground force being Iranian proxies like Hezbollah and other militias coming from Iraq. So that should be very concerning. So we saw something positive on April 6th, and since then we've seen both Assad, Russia, and Iran adjust. And I'll throw it to you.
So I think what's interesting in what Michael says is that the reason a lot of us supported, including myself as a Democrat and a former Obama appointee, we supported those airstrikes not because they would change the trajectory of this conflict. And I don't think most people were arguing that they would necessarily change it. It was because they sent a message, which is not unimportant. I mean, I'm in communications, believe me. I think messages are very important. But so for about 24 hours, there was a lot of positive commentary that this sent a message to the Assad regime that your actions will have consequences and that the United States is not afraid to use military power. That's not insignificant. For me, the question of Syria, whether it's what to do with Assad, the moderate opposition, how to continue fighting ISIS, is beyond that very, very limited use. And Michael's right. In 2013, the package of strikes that was presented to us from the military was actually much more robust. It was about 48 to 72 hours of strikes, if that's the path we had chosen to go down. But beyond that limited strike, what is the overall policy in Syria? You know, in the course of 2 weeks, we saw the Trump administration start by saying Assad maybe didn't have to go, or the Syrian people could decide whether he had to go, to no, Assad still has to go. And look, I fully give administrations credit for getting into office, facing the realities, and changing from what you said on the campaign. I think that's natural. I think it's often healthy. I would argue on Trump's rhetoric on something like NATO, for example, that's healthy and probably a natural outgrowth of being the one governing. But in Syria, I still don't have a clear sense for what the strategy is. They haven't sent high-level folks to the talks, the diplomatic talks, about where Syria is going to go from here on the diplomatic path. I think that's one recommendation I would give, to re-engage at a higher level, to get some senior people at the State Department who can engage at that level. I get the focus on ISIS. That seems pretty clear to me. But the rest of it, I still think people like H.R. McMaster, who I know you worked for and with, these are smart folks who I hope and trust are sitting there right now thinking, okay, what's the medium and longer term strategy? We can't do this day by day in Syria. That's led, I think, to not great outcomes in the past. You're up.
Well, thank you to our hosts at Hudson Institute for having us. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to have a chance to speak to all of you. And as Susie said, we want to make this an interactive discussion, and we want to mix it up and debate, and there'll also be a chance for Q&A at the end. With respect to the Syria airstrikes, my view is that this is the signature achievement of the Trump administration in the first 100, 110 days. The strikes happened about 35 days ago. They were an extraordinary turn of events for this administration. Certainly a few months ago, nobody would have expected that the Trump administration would order anything like a missile strike against the Assad regime. Even the week before the strikes happened, it seemed that it would not happen. Secretary of State Tillerson had made comments that suggested that the administration was going to pivot towards Assad, not away from Assad. It is, as Marie sent, an extraordinary symbolic message about the U.S.'s lack of tolerance for the types of atrocities that the Assad regime is committing in Syria and that Russia has supported. Mm-hmm. But I also agree with Marie that it's not clear what the strategy is going forward. And to the extent that the missile strike has caused Syria and the Assad regime to worry about the repercussions from the U.S., if they engage in further atrocities. And it has also similarly made Russia worry about the U.S. stepping up involvement in Syria. The longer we wait to do something else to signal that we have a continuing interest and policy in Syria, the more attenuated the impact of those strikes will become. And now you take the most recent thing that has happened with respect to Syria, which is the Astana talks and the agreement on de-escalation zones. And you have to note the lack of involvement or leadership by the U.S. and by the Trump administration in that agreement and in those talks. And you have to wonder what is going on and what is the Trump administration going to do next. There hasn't been a clear statement about the result of those talks, which is these four de-escalation zones. The opposition in Syria does not support the agreement that came out of the Astana talks. The de-escalation zones are problematic in the sense that they are not safe zones, and they're also problematic in terms of the zones that were chosen, which were conspicuously supported by the Assad regime, and may in fact be zones where it actually just helps the Assad regime to de-escalate violence. It doesn't help the other actors. So My question, as Marie mentioned, is what is the strategy going forward? I would like to see a consistent strategy, and I firmly believe we should continue with the Obama administration's policy that Assad must go.
So I think it's interesting that all three of us probably agree on two things, that we should have, and correct me if I'm wrong, that we should have taken military action in Syria actually before 2013, that the best opportunity to really hurt Assad was probably 2012, late 2011, 2012. And we all support the 59 strikes. And I think we all probably want to see a comprehensive strategy outlined for where things go from here.
So on that note, then can you tell us why it took so long why did it take a president like Mr. Trump to come in and actually do something?
By do something, mean take strikes mm-hmm. militarily? That's a very complicated question.
What happened in 2013?
So what I just said was, look, I think a lot of people who follow this think that the time we could have had the most impact on the Assad regime by doing things like crater and runways would have been 2012. So starting from that standpoint, and I know this is controversial, but in 2013, in 2013, we were presented with the president did make a decision, which he announced publicly, to strike. And then sort of in the later hours of that decision making, decided after the UK had voted down strikes that given what the UK had done, it was important to go to Congress. That is a interesting point that we can debate. Legally, we didn't think we had to. He felt politically we had to. And what I remind people is, at that time, sitting in meetings with Secretary Kerry, who had done all member calls, he had had multiple meetings on the Hill, members of Congress were begging us to strike, and they were begging us to come to them. And that history has been has been forgotten, I think, because they were saying, we want you to strike, we want you to come to us. So when the president made that decision to go to Congress, whether or not you agreed with it, we did, at least at first, legitimately believe Congress would say yes. And I'm not putting this all on Congress. I'm just, some of this history has been either forgotten or, I don't know, muddled.
So are you saying it all came down to the UK then?
So no. So then the question was, Congress essentially said no, said we were not going to support you. So then we had a decision to make. Do we go without Congress, which we could have done legally? Which would have been problematic in some ways, though. We had Republicans yelling at us saying, we want you to do more. We had Democrats saying, we want you to do less. And, you know, it's like Goldilocks. We were kind of caught in the middle. So you either go without Congress or you find another option. And what my boss, Secretary Kerry, did was negotiate an agreement that got an extraordinary amount of chemical weapons out of Syria. Was it all of them? No. Obviously no. And we can talk about the reasons for that, declared versus
undeclared. You were declared, right?
Right. So and so what happened after this was when we would have evidence that there were weapons they hadn't declared that hadn't been gotten out, we would give that to the OPCW, we'd give that to the UN. They're not investigative bodies. This was during an ongoing civil war. I'm not making excuses here, I'm just trying to explain what happened. So in our mind, getting those tons and tons of weapons out, more than we went to war over in Iraq, by the way, which we thought the Iraqis had. I'm trying to get people to say, in and of itself, getting those weapons out, so today they're not in the hands of ISIS, which a lot of them would be given where they were located, or Assad, was in and of itself a good thing. Now, did not enforcing the red line hurt us diplomatically? Absolutely. Did it give some people the notion that they used politically that we were unwilling to use military action or get involved? Absolutely. Those things are all true. They can all be true, right? So that was a long answer to your question, but I think that in general in Syria, President Obama was very hesitant to get involved militarily in the Middle East in another country. Now, he ultimately did a number of ways in Syria in fighting ISIS. But came into office having, for better or worse, looked at the war in Iraq and said, A, I don't think it's smart to get bogged down. And he was worried that we would get bogged down. He was worried that we couldn't say option 3 and 4 and 5, what happens down the road. I think sometimes you don't know that and you just have to act. But that is why I think, and the American people, quite frankly, were not clamoring to go back into the Middle East. So that's some context for all of this.
And that's usually what the argument is. You do nothing or you do everything.
Right, which is a problem.
And there's always something in the middle. So it's either do nothing or commit 130,000 troops to an endeavor and you have prolonged war. The interesting thing, and I didn't mean, or I wanted to interrupt you, but I didn't.
I know. I could see. I could tell. You're very polite.
Was there any hope? Because a lot of us believe there was a hope by the Obama administration that Congress would say no so they could justify not doing anything.
So that's an interesting question. That's become, I think, popular myth, or that's become what people assume, that that's why President Obama did it, because he actually didn't want to strike, and he was hoping Congress would say no. I mean, I can't get in President Obama's head as much as I would like to. I was sitting at the State Department with
him. Rhodes could, though.
Well, you know, let's not go there. But I was sitting at the State Department working for John Kerry, who, it's not a secret, wanted to do more in Syria, including militarily. That is not it. He did not make that
a
secret.
He was frustrated.
Right. So I was sitting there with him. Look, he's also a creature of the Senate, so he understood the respect that was being given. So what I can tell you is, from our perspective at the State Department and the conversations John Kerry was having with his former colleagues, they were saying, we will vote for you. And that's what, when Kerry then went up to testify, we all went up with him, he testified for hours and hours and hours on this before the Foreign Relations Committee. There really was a sense that Congress wanted to say yes. The politics then changed.
I would just say, having looked at that issue at the time, I find it hard to believe that you could have thought that Congress would pass a measure to support President Obama when the House was controlled by the Republicans, and the Republicans disagreed with President Obama on just about everything, and were looking for more things to fight him on. And one of the sort of real inconsistencies in the Obama administration, from my point of view as a person who supported President Obama, is the decision to go into Libya without any congressional authorization, and to resist attempts by Congress to force the administration to get a congressional authorization in Libya, which the Obama administration at the time justified on the basis that we don't need congressional authorization to do a military intervention. And the Obama administration exceeded the periods under the War Powers Resolution and justified that on the grounds that we did not have people on the ground. This was just an air campaign, and therefore we didn't have to follow the War Powers Resolution. And then decides in Syria that none of those justifications applied and that we actually have to get congressional authorization.
Not that we have to. We never said legally we
had to. That we needed to, or there was an imperative.
Right.
When the Obama administration insisted it didn't need it for Libya, there's an internal inconsistency there, especially when you look at the fact that President Obama had drawn a red line in Syria. The red line didn't say, I will act if Assad uses chemical weapons and if Congress lets me do so.
Is it because Iran didn't care what we did in Libya?
No, this is another myth.
Yes, I mean, we'd be remiss not to mention Iran's role.
So let's bring up Iran here, but let me just really quickly respond to you. That, I mean, first of all, it got voted out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And this was one place where Republicans were saying, we want you to act. We've been asking for years. And so I think we did learn a lesson from Libya. Well, we learned a bunch of lessons from Libya. But when it comes to Congress, I do think, and from what happened to the United Kingdom, and I think broadly speaking, and we don't have to go down this rabbit hole now, we then tried to get an authorization for the use of military force for Syria, which went nowhere in Congress because everyone was fighting. There is actually a really interesting conversation that could take up a whole day about what role Congress plays in foreign policy and how when our administration went to them and said, please be an equal branch, they were like, whoa, we don't want to have to own that. Both sides of the aisle, right? So that's a whole other conversation. There is this myth out there that in September 2013, when we were talking about whether to strike, August, September timeframe, that Iran factored into our calculations. And I can tell you, as someone who was there at the time and who then did the Iran negotiations, I mean, Secretary Kerry didn't even meet with Javad Zarif until at least a month later, which in New York, which is what restarted the nuclear talks. So yeah, there were these secret behind the scenes talks about whether or not possibly we could ever negotiate someday. But there were no nuclear negotiations at the time. The JPOA, the first step, wasn't done till the end of November. So I can promise you there were a lot of things that went into this decision about whether to strike. I was never in a meeting or a conversation where Iran was part of that. And people might not believe me, but I can just tell you what I heard.
Well, bring it back into Trump's first 100 days.
Yeah. Right.
So there were We're officials. No, no, but we need to lay the context. We need to lay the groundwork here to do the context.
We could talk about this all day.
There were people in the administration that were worried that if we did something in Syria, that it would affect the JCPOA. Leon Panetta said as much, that if we went against Iran's
people in the Obama
interests, yes, went against Iran's interests in Syria and Iraq, it could derail the JCPOA. Well, the first 100 days of the Trump administration have actually proven that false. Iran didn't walk away when we struck Assad's air base in Syria. They didn't walk away when we announced new sanctions on Iranian facilitation or export of terrorism.
Right.
So we've called Iran's bluff, meaning the U.S. has called Iran's bluff, something the last administration, some critics would say, was afraid to do because it would derail the JCPOA.
Yeah.
So I think it's great now. So we've called Iran's bluff. We know they're not going to walk away from the Iran deal if we do things in Syria, and we should do more.
Yeah. Well, and just a word on Leon Panetta. I mean, I worked for him when he was CIA director. I was his spokesperson. He left the administration long before the Iran deal was ever negotiated. And I think his insights are interesting, but not informed by actually policy discussions because he wasn't there. So as much as I like him, I discount a little bit of what he has to say. I think that you are right that the Iran deal is more durable than sometimes people fear on both sides. We can take more politically here at home, and I think the Iranians can take more. We designated a number of Iranian entities in the Obama administration after the deal. The Iranians always throw a fit, and it still holds. I don't know if there's a scientific way to find where that line is. I think one thing I would at least, and we've talked about this before, the Iranians are in their own political season. They have a presidential election coming up. They have their own domestic politics, which sometimes we in the U.S. forget because it seems like a monolith. And they say a lot publicly for domestic political consumption. What I look at, right, is those diplomatic conversations between our experts and their experts. Are they continuing to do what they said they do on the nuclear side? They are. And so which is a good thing for now. So I you're right that I think it is more durable than we think, but I don't think we should discount that there is a line after which the Iranians will say, you guys aren't upholding your end of the bargain. And we're not close to that now.
Well, the main complaint.
What does that line look like?
Well, I mean, you know, look at the 159 pages in Alta of the deal, and we can talk about that. But we were very clear during the negotiations with Iran that we would continue to sanction them for terrorism, human rights, ballistic missiles, all those things. I know you want more. I know you're a big proponent of more sanctions, and that we would continue to have differing interests in a whole bunch of issues. They complain about that publicly because they complain about everything publicly. But so far, it hasn't affected the deal.
And the biggest complaint is something I think we all agreed on last night, was that Zarif keeps complaining that we haven't opened up the U.S. banking system to Iran. And that's something we should continue to do, right? Deny Iran access to the U.S. dollar, to the U.S. banking system, as long as they support terrorism, export terrorism.
Yeah, and we're not lifting the embargo. I mean, if anyone remembers talking about campaign rhetoric, President Trump at one point as a candidate said, we got a terrible deal because American businesses can't benefit from this. He almost like flirted with lifting the embargo, which I don't think he actually meant. It was a flash in the pan and then it went away. But none of us would want to open the U.S. banking system to Iran for a whole bunch of reasons, right? And that was certainly never something we agreed to do.
But Zarif keeps insisting that it was a promise made by Kerry that we would do that.
Well, it's not in the deal and he knows that. And, you know, again, people hearsay things for domestic political reasons. I mean, you know, I lived through Tom Cotton writing that letter to directly to the Iranian government during the negotiations. And, you know, they get that we have our own politics, too. And what matters is what's actually happening on the ground.
So there's a lot more tougher tone and tougher rhetoric on Iran, right? But is Trump doing anything so differently towards Iran than Obama right now? And on that note, towards ISIS? I mean, he talked about bombing the hell out of ISIS on the trail, but is his policy on these two fronts really that different? And obviously, you know, Iran is on the ground in Iraq, so that's why these two are tied together.
With respect to Iran, I personally have not detected anything tangible that shows a different stance by the Trump administration with respect to Iran, except for statements that President Trump and the administration have made. So we're yet to see what's going to happen. I would note that Secretary of State Tillerson certified to Congress 3 weeks ago that Iran is complying with the nuclear agreement, which was a surprise. I think the Trump administration was presented with a difficult choice. They had to certify to Congress whether or not Iran was complying, but they made a choice to say it was. If they had said Iran is not complying, the agreement would immediately have started to fall apart, and the U.S. would no longer have the obligation to continue to roll back sanctions. So the Trump administration made that affirmative decision to continue to comply with the Iran agreement, which is a stark contrast to what President Trump said during the campaign when he said he would rip up the deal on the first day. And I think he's facing the reality that you can't just tear up this deal. Even if you didn't support the elements of it at the time we signed it, we have certain obligations and we're receiving certain benefits from it. And we've given up certain things to Iran that make it wise to continue with the agreement. The question is, what are we going to do outside of the agreement to curb Iran's support for terrorism, its support for groups like Hezbollah, and the other things that Iran does to foment violence and destabilization in the region? And I have yet to see any action by the Trump administration on that.
What are some recommendations you would give them, how they could confront that activity? Aggressively.
I don't want to delve too much back into Syria, but a lot of it is with respect to Syria. The flirtation by the Trump administration with supporting Assad would also be a marked movement towards Iran on Syria, which I think would be a huge mistake. So in Syria, what we ought to be doing is insisting that Iran does not have a role in a legitimate role in deciding the future of Syria, and that the best thing Iran could do would be to pull back its support for Hezbollah and the groups in Syria. And Iran should not have been part of the Astana agreements and should not be part of the Geneva talks in a significant way. That would be one important one.
So wait, that's actually interesting. And I'm very curious to hear both of your thoughts on this. We pushed the Saudis to let the Iranians sit at the talks for negotiations because, while none of us really want Iran to be there, they are a player in Syria, and pretending like they're not ignores, as we all know, a reality on the ground. So is there a way to get a diplomatic agreement or something, path forward, without one of the key players at the table? Do you guys think?
Well, I should amend my statement. If Iran is going to be there, it should play a different role than it's played thus far.
Okay.
Its role should be with the objective towards a political resolution, which would involve Assad eventually stepping down. And in fact, one of the most likely ways we will ultimately, if we ever get Assad to step down voluntarily, will be from Iran and Russia pressuring him to do so.
Okay. Thank you.
So we all agree with this, then?
No.
I thought we were all trying to agree the whole thing.
No, I agree. I agree that
yield the floor to the gentleman from Texas.
The gentleman from Texas requests 2 minutes. So with regards to Iran, what is Iran doing in Syria? For them, the removal of Assad is a red line. They are moving Iraqi Shia militias to Syria, not to defeat ISIS, but to keep Assad in power.
The removal militarily or through some diplomatic solution where he's no longer part of the future of Syria?
Well,
are those both the red lines for Iran?
The red line. They want him in place, or at least somebody from his family in place to maintain the regime. Their Shia crescent is very important to them, that, you know, Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut link. So what Iran is doing now, it's buying up properties and moving in Shia pilgrims and exiting Sunni populations to be able to change the demographics in Syria in places. These safe zones that they're setting up, these no-fly zones, what we need to do, we talked about what should the Trump administration do now. We need to put in our own safe zones now, our own no-fly zones now, and do things. Because if you look at the territory that Russia and Turkey and Iran are marking up, Russia and Iran agree on the locations that protect the regime, and Turkey's safe zone is to keep the YPG and the PKK from doing more in the area. More so on maintaining control of those areas than fighting ISIS. So that leaves the U.S. with the role of Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor. What do we do there? What do we do with ISIS? And we're starting to lose territory on this chessboard that everybody else is taking over because we're not doing anything about it. So we need to do that now. Every calculation that Russia, Iran, and by extension North Korea and ISIS and other groups have taken is based on U.S. inaction. Let's do this because the Americans
military
can't do
inaction.
Anything. Military inaction. And that's the most important thing right now when it comes to Syria is, you know, establishment of a safe zone or a no-fly zone is a military action without the kinetic action necessarily. But we're losing time and space to be able to do these things. And again, Iran and ISIS see Iraq and Syria as one battlefield. They don't see a border. So Iran is able to do a lot of things in Iraq that we're not paying attention to. Right now, and we talked about this last night, so we were talking about, so what is the response if we go after Iran's nuclear program? If we do an 8-hour air raid and we set them back 10 years, what is the response?
I was not advocating for that.
No. This is just a hypothetical question.
We were wargaming last night over.
What is the response? Usually it's a Hezbollah rocket attack on Israel. That's the first thing that we can expect. But now there's a different dynamic in that the U.S. forces in Iraq are outnumbered 20 to 1 by IRGC-affiliated Shia militias, not only in the Iraqi military, but in the Hashd al-Shaabi and other groups like Asab Ahl al-Haq and Kitab Hezbollah. So literally, you have 5,000 to 7,000 U.S. advisors, basically targets
back in
for
Iraq.
Iranian reprisal if we do something. So that calculation has to be in there. And like you mentioned last night, all Iran ever has to do is simply ratchet it up a little bit, and there's destabilization. And it's something that Mattis said, and I think was very good for our Sunni regional allies to hear that, and for Israel to hear that, and for a lot of people in this country to hear, that anytime you see something nefarious or something going wrong in the Middle East, you can look to Iran as part of the reason for that instability. So those are positive messages. But again, there is the diplomatic part that you're talking about. How does Iran become a productive partner in this?
We're not even productive, right? Let's not.
They don't.
They
build airfields like they do in Iraq. They provide electricity like they do in Iraq. They demonstrate the ability to do things in Iraq that the Iraqi government cannot do, such as build infrastructure.
So that's
a positive thing in Iraq, but the militias, the IRG influence, the influence on the Shia political parties is destabilizing.
And there are two things that we've also talked about that it seems like both McMaster and Mattis are very informed in their how they view Iran through their experience in Iraq, which we're all informed by our experiences. But that, I think, has become very clear through how they're dealing with Iran. You know, the argument I would make, I mean, the nuclear deal, it all seems like we're putting in a sort of a separate category because it's in place and it's working and the Trump administration needs to figure out what they're doing with it. But that was exactly why we wanted, and we can argue about the deal and its merits or demerits, as people see, but precisely because of all the negative and nefarious things they do in the region, from our perspective, it was most important to make sure they couldn't do that backed up by a nuclear weapon. And that's why we focus so much on these nuclear issues.
Well, I think the reason for, again, Tillerson certified the State Department saying that Iran was complying with the JCPOA. And then North Korea did what it did. So North Korea is Iran's worst enemy right now. Because Tillerson has now said, we do not want Iran, and this deal, the JCPOA, does allow Iran to become a nuclear power if it doesn't cheat in 12 to 15 years. If it does cheat in 1 year.
A nuclear weapons power? Or nuclear power. I mean, they already know how to make nuclear fuel.
To develop a nuclear weapon.
Okay, well, we can debate that. But let's talk about North Korea. Well,
so that's the reason for the relook on the JCPOA is based on what North Korea has done. Because it's the same deal Clinton secured with the North Koreans.
No. The deal Clinton secured was like 4 pages and had no transparency. The additional protocol wasn't even in place at the IAEA.
It didn't have the 20 pages of sanctions relief to
and
to
the 35 Qasem Soleimani
and the IRGC
and the 35
and the
pages of nuclear. Restrictions that Iran is adhering to. It is true that after 15 years, until year 15, Iran is not allowed to have enough fissile material or make it at a high enough enriched rate that it could build a bomb. So for 15 years, if they hold to it, and we're making, you know, watching, I know the intelligence community where a lot of us have worked is watching very closely. There is a question after year 15, there are restrictions that go out to 20 and 25, and there are some restrictions in the deal that last forever, but some of the restrictions start to come off. So there is a legitimate question as policymakers. I don't know if the Trump administration, you know, we're not quite there yet. We're only at day 110, but at some point in year 8, when we get towards the broader conclusion, which is something the IAEA issues for nuclear states, when we get towards year 10, I hope that then policymakers are going to be discussing what happens after that and how we continue to enforce the provisions of the deal that remain in effect, and we'll see where Iran is then, we'll see where the U.S. is then. There's a whole bunch of factors that will happen between now and then. But do you want to go back to ISIS? Or?
Well,
I feel like you did. I could
yeah,
feel
so
it.
You also asked about ISIS and if there has been a discernible change in policy by the Trump administration with respect to ISIS. And I have not really seen that yet, other than a couple of things. First of all, I do think that the Trump administration has loosened the rules of engagement for U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq and Syria, and has increased the number of special forces in Iraq and in Syria, and is planning to continue to increase those forces. But otherwise, the Trump administration seems to be following the battle plan of the Obama administration with respect to liberating Mosul. In Mosul, about half of Western Mosul has now been liberated, and you can expect ISIS to continue to fight in the parts of Western Mosul where they are, but they will eventually be pushed out. ISIS continues to be in two other major cities in Iraq, Hawija and Tal Afar, and there are questions about how we're going to liberate those cities and which forces on the ground will be part of the coalition that will liberate those cities. But I think you can expect during this year for those cities to be liberated as well. The questions that the Obama administration kicked down the road with respect to Iraq, like post-Mosul liberation governance and security, have not been resolved by the Trump administration. And I have not seen what the plan is for resolving those questions.
Real quick, so this might be a criticism of the Trump administration has loosened the restrictions for being able to conduct attacks on the ground. So loosen the rules of engagement. One of the biggest problems that I see is in the continuation of what Obama's doing is that we continue to provide a kinetic resource to Iranian proxies on the ground in Iraq. And what we're doing with Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa, we're using a Kurdish force to go into a Sunni area, a predominantly Kurdish force to go into the Sunni areas of Deir ez-Zor and Raqqa. Again, in Iraq, we've yet to build the clear and hold force that can actually keep ISIS out of any place we've cleared yet. And in Syria, we're doing the same thing. Now, the rules of engagement. So if you look at the attack in Mosul, where the U.S. is being blamed for the deaths of 200 Sunni civilians in Mosul, that was based on using an Iranian proxy on the ground to provide the details for that strike. And when I say that, is it was a federal police unit that actually recommended this. Well, the federal police is heavily dominated by Badr Corps and Shia militias. In Raqqa, when we did the same thing, the Raqqa offensive, north of Raqqa, we used, again, a person on the ground to tell us to drop U.S. steel on target, and we ended up killing coalition members. So the strategy needs to change in that it needs to be U.S. eyes and ears on the ground directing in U.S. munitions to avoid civilian casualties. Now, one interesting thing, I don't know if anybody's noticed that the new director for the Iraqi Ministry of Interior is a former IRGC lieutenant, Qasem al-Araji. He was detained at Cropper. He was part of the IRGC-led insurgency that were both targeting Americans and targeting Iraqi politicians that didn't want to stay in line. He defended the U.S. killing 200 Sunni civilians because he's okay with that. It's okay to bomb Sunni civilians in Mosul because at the end of the day, they're collaborators. They allowed ISIS in. So we have to look at all these things. And I think with regard to Syria and Iraq, and to your point, We haven't started fighting ISIS as they move into the al-Qaeda model. We're so heavily focused on taking terrain away that we're ignoring that ISIS can conduct attacks in Baghdad, Ramadi, Fallujah, Tikrit, and every area that has been cleared in the past, ISIS still has cells. They've just learned not to plant a black flag and not to tell anybody that they're in control of this territory. So we're simply resetting the conditions if we don't change this. And that's one of the things that, you know, having worked for both Mattis and McMaster, and before Flynn was fired, they all said three things. The only way to defeat a Sunni insurgent group is with Sunni intelligence and Sunni manpower. And that provides the, and also to, along with that, to provide the political space to get their government to start reconciling with their estranged populations. And the Trump administration, I think, is accelerating the use of force to declare a victory against ISIS. And I think we're simply resetting the conditions to the day before ISIS rolled in.
On that note,
sorry.
And more depressing.
Well, it might be a good time to move on to, you know, speaking of ISIS, moving on to Libya. Which is another place that you have a lot of experience and you worked with the rebels there, the National Training Council. We saw that Trump had a visit with the Italian Prime Minister and, you know, he said that he hands off Libya. Presumably the Libya will come up in his meeting with the Pope when he goes to the Vatican. What do we do about Libya? What should he do?
Well, with respect to Libya and the Middle East more broadly, you know, one of the things that a lot of people were anxious about is how hard it is to predict what the Trump administration will do in the Middle East. And nowhere was it more difficult to predict than Libya, where there were almost no pronouncements or just statements by the Trump administration, by Trump during the campaign about Libya, other than just criticizing the Benghazi, the attack on the mission in Benghazi, and blaming Hillary Clinton for that. The first substantive statement President Trump has said about Libya is what he said in the meeting with the Italian Prime Minister, which was basically, we don't have an interest there. I think personally that's a big mistake. We have a very significant interest in Libya, but that confirmed what I think a lot of Libyans worried about, which is that it would be quite easy for President Trump to ignore Libya, because if things go south in Libya, that's one of the easiest places for President Trump to blame the previous administration. He can just say it's Libya, the mistakes and problems in Libya are the result of the Obama administration, of President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and wash his hands and ignore Libya. And while it's true that Europe has and is even greater, more impacted by Libya than the U.S., the U.S. has very significant interests there as well. And unfortunately, I don't think there will be a resolution to the current crisis in Libya without some leadership from the U.S. And people in Libya are looking for leadership from the U.S. Now, there have been some developments in the last week that are positive with respect to Libya. There was a meeting from Prime Minister Sarraj of the Government of National Accord and General Haftar. There is some discussion that they've reached some sort of agreement. They have been rivals and associated with rival governments up until now. It is at least possible that they have agreed on elections. That's what the media is reporting, that there would be elections in 2018. But a lot needs to be done to get to the point of us having fair elections, and that will include solving some governance issues and in particularly solving security issues, and most importantly, getting some of the militias to stand down. And that, in my view, as I said before, is going to take leadership from the U.S. We cannot afford to have Libya become a failed state. And although Libya is in a crisis, it is not where Syria is. And in my view, if we do not engage in Libya in a more significant way, it will end up like Syria.
And here's where I'm going to take this back to my time at the State Department, or to the State Department in general. The fact that they haven't appointed senior people, I know, like, State Department staffing is not that sexy an issue, but it has some real world impacts. You know, the last year of the Obama administration, John Kerry, and you can criticize the substance of what he was trying to negotiate, but he was personally involved in the negotiations over Libya, Yemen, Syria, obviously Iran. And I'm not saying Secretary Tillerson needs to be the one doing all this, but they don't have assistant secretaries tasked with this. They don't have senior special envoys tasked with this. Who from the U.S. is looking at Libya today?
Well, I think
and how can you play, but how can you play, to your point, a senior, a leading role, the United States of America, leading from in front, as we all want America to do, if you don't have people at the State Department or at the National Security Council, not Jared Kushner, who has a lot on his plate already, but people at the National Security Council or at the State Department, senior people who are tasked with playing a United States leadership role here, I don't think anybody is. And that worries me.
I
someone who thinks diplomacy should be a key tool of international relations and American power in the world.
I think Brett McGurk's to blame, and I'll tell you why.
I can't wait to hear that.
He's doing everything. He's the president's envoy to defeat ISIS. He does that. He secured the release of American prisoners by making sure that the pallet of 140 $1.4 billion landed before Jason Rezaian could be released. But I think he's doing too good a job. And the reason I say that, or he looks like he can do everything, is because he'll actually tweet that five ISIS were killed today in two vehicles.
But that's not my question. We had senior envoys for Libya. We had someone senior working on Yemen. We had a senior person attending all of the Syrian negotiations.
Brett McGurk can do it all.
Well, no. I mean, I know that's a funny one-liner, but, you know, we had senior diplomats, and Secretary Kerry or Deputy Secretary Tony Blinken were intimately familiar with all of the details of these negotiations. And I had high hopes for Rex Tillerson when he came in because, you know, I thought he brought a lot of experience and didn't seem over ideological. I don't think he wants the job. He said very publicly he didn't want it. And I have seen no indications that he is willing to take the steps, even with some restructuring, to staff up the State Department and American diplomacy as a result and make sure we are showing leadership. Because if we don't, Russia's going to, China's going to, Iran's going to, and we're going to be left sitting here thinking, where's America?
Right.
And that is a problem no matter what political party you're a part of.
And Madison and McMaster both suggested that the State Department not be cut and that it actually
be staffed. Well, Tillerson needs to suggest that because I think he supports some of these cuts, and I hear from my former colleagues that they are terrified. And that's a problem.
Well, we're already seeing, you know, Russia kind of its influence growing in Libya.
Definitely working with Sisi. I mean, where the U.S. disengaged under the Obama administration, Putin started filling the gaps. We've seen this by courting Sisi, courting Erdogan in some cases, but definitely in Libya, to the point where if you look at where Russia's actually fighting ISIS, well, they're not fighting ISIS in Syria. They're not, but they are helping Sisi fight ISIS along the Libyan-Egyptian border.
Yeah.
And they say they're helping to fight ISIS in Afghanistan by providing lethal aid to the Taliban, which kills Americans. So there are a lot of places where when we look at what Russia's doing, we need to look at what they're doing in Syria and their complicity in the killing of civilians. We need to make Russia responsible for everything that goes wrong in Syria, basically calling them Assad's Air Force.
How do we do that?
By grounding Assad's Air Force, and that would be something I would recommend, and I'm sure based on your 72-hour target packet that you talked about in 2013, I think that was actually the goal, to ground Assad's Air Force, leaving Putin responsible for any munition that falls on the civilian. But looking at what Russia's doing in other places, Tillerson made some comments on human rights, and that was something that was pretty interesting, that had Senator McCain respond in an op-ed saying that that's not what America's about. But to Tillerson's point, I mean, if we want to curb North Korea's nuclear program, we need to ask human rights violator China to weigh in. We need to ask human rights violator Russia to weigh in. If we want to solve the situation in Syria, we need to ask human rights violator Iran to do the right thing, human rights violator Russia to do the right thing, all without the preconditions of fixing their human rights issues. So I can see the pragmatic argument that if the U.S. wants to get things done, you can't ask China, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia to fix their human rights issues first before they help us with ISIS, Al-Qaeda.
Well, you make a calculation about what's the most important threat or what's the best interest. I mean, the interesting thing about your argument, and I don't necessarily disagree, is that that's not a traditional Republican argument. And you've seen not just John McCain, but Marco Rubio and other Republicans who slammed our administration for 8 years for not standing up for dissidents in Russia or wherever.
Or not addressing human rights, and but striking a nuclear deal.
Exactly. Right, right. So, I mean, just domestically in the United States, when it comes to how we talk about foreign policy, we're in an interesting sort of parallel, weird universe that I haven't quite figured out yet.
Yeah, I think...
Candidly.
The real world versus the ideal world.
I mean, the Secretary of State's statement is stupefying, and it's particularly odd for a Secretary of State to say that. And we are in the odd position of actually maybe having a Secretary of Defense who's more willing to stand up for human rights abroad than our Secretary of State. And I think that's what, you know, Senator McCain's is complaining about. And obviously it's hard to enforce our priorities abroad at the same time as, you know, trying to force countries to obey human rights. But some of the things that we do, you can only base them and justify them based on human rights. And go back to the missile strikes in Syria. The only possible justification for the missile strikes in Syria was a human rights, humanitarian-based justification for under the responsibility to protect of the United Nations, which was that we engaged in military force in Syria without the permission of the country, without even a UN Security Council resolution, because we felt we had to do so in order to stop the atrocities in Syria. And this administration ought to be honest about that and say that's why we did it and indicate that we're willing to do that in other places if as a last resort, if we have to do so. But Secretary Tillerson seems to be saying, no, I don't agree with that.
Well, since the 59 cruise missile strike on Syria, there have been 248 Sunni civilians killed by other munitions dropped from airplanes, and we should be as outraged about that. Exactly, in Syria. We should be as outraged about that. And then, you know, two sarin attacks, two nerve gas attacks happened December 12th, on December 12th in two different areas, killing, you know, 72 people. And I don't even remember hearing about that.
No, I don't either. And that's, you know, there's a whole other conversation about the media and what gets covered, and BBC does better than most, I will say. But what became interesting to me about the debate about using military force in Syria in the last year and a half of the Obama administration was the military privately but also publicly said, if we make a strategic decision to use military assets against the Assad regime, that takes away assets from going after ISIS. And they said that publicly. And it's not one-to-one, and you guys are much better experts on this than I am. But that was an argument that we heard a lot from military leaders. And because we had made a decision that ISIS was the priority, I think that some people in the Obama administration, when they would hear that, would say, we don't want to take any resources away from ISIS. And it's just an interesting, I mean, resources are, we have a lot of resources in the military, but they're not infinite, right?
Well, on that note, we'd be remiss to not mention the Arab-Israeli peace process.
We're going to solve everything today.
Dave has thoughts on.
Well, I mean, the one thing that we thought this administration would focus on in the Middle East is the Middle East peace process. And in fact, it's the one thing that President Trump discussed quite a lot. He appointed someone very close to him, his son-in-law, to be in charge of the Middle East peace process. I think his statements have consisted of saying that Middle East peace is achievable and we can achieve it. Why can't we achieve it? But in his exuberance, I think he's overlooked how difficult it is. But I would note he had a meeting with Abbas, and he has started the process of getting smart on the issues. And that's important because just engaging at the beginning is integral to creating a process. And other presidents have waited too long in their presidency to try to tackle this very difficult, thorny issue. I would also note, and again, trying to compare what President has done in his first 100 days in office versus what he said he would do, that he has pivoted away from one of the things he said he would do, which was to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which I think would have actually been an impediment to the peace process without bringing any real positives back to the U.S. We're not going to gain anything by moving our embassy. We're not able to do diplomacy better from Jerusalem than Tel Aviv. And it would be also a very substantial expense to build a new embassy in Jerusalem. So in terms of activities and actions that we have seen so far with respect to the Middle East peace process, we've seen the meeting with Abbas. We know he's going to Israel, and certainly the process, peace process, will be on the agenda there. And we see a slight pivot away from a very, very strong support for Israel navigating towards a position that maybe will be more amenable to the Palestinians, which is necessary, I think, for if the U.S. is going to be involved in brokering a deal. But
he
don't
walks away from his support of the settlements, which was
exactly.
But they haven't focused on the concept of a two-state solution, which I don't know if it's on purpose or not. I mean, I'm assuming it's on purpose. But you said something that I think is really key here, that he's clearly focused on it, and he has to get, if he's going to do something, get started soon. Because one thing we all know is that the daily crises just consume you. And that's why, you know, we all agree that he has a good team in McMaster, in Mattis, in Nikki Haley, I think, is doing a great job at the UN. There's a lot of crises. We've talked about a couple of them that will take up all of your time. If you don't have someone sitting down and saying, what's our strategy on something like Middle East peace? That's not a daily crisis, thankfully, right now. So what could these negotiations look like, and how do we get there? You know, when we restarted the negotiations in 2013, that took dozens of hours of the Secretary of State on the ground. I was there for a lot of them to even get them at the table again. That may not be the right model, but I hope, if I were to give them advice, that the Trump administration is thinking through, and the visit to Israel will be very important, and the Abbas meeting was important, but finding time in this crazy world to think about how that might happen, because the days will get away from you very quickly.
Well, that begs a question. Is there too much on Jared Kushner's plate?
Well, hopefully he's not doing it by himself. Maybe you could ask Brett McGurk to help out.
Oh,
that's the last time
I
mentioned him.
I need a bingo card. I would already have bingo.
Yes, yellow card.
Yeah,
right.
I see you got a yellow card. Thank you.
Isn't that the strategy to go and meet with the Israelis and meet with the Saudis and to get the Gulf states to put pressure on the Palestinians to accept a two-state solution, and also to get Israel to accept it as well, based on this new alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel, at least the hopes of that, to counter Iranian influence in the region.
So it was interesting when Secretary Kerry gave his quite controversial speech about Middle East peace before we left office. One of the most interesting things to come out of that didn't get a lot of coverage, but was that a lot of the Arab states who had been part of the Arab Peace Initiative did publicly agree to the notion of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Now, that's not determinative, but that's kind of important, right? So, again, I don't want to keep going back to staffing, but every administration who's ever tried to do this appointed someone very senior to be an envoy to Middle East peace, because it takes so much legwork, it takes so much on-the-ground work. We had Martin Indyk, people remember Dennis Ross and others. Is that Jared?
No, there is someone else. We
Who? No, but his attorney, who's based out of the White House, right? Is that right? So is he the person, then, to your point, is he the person that is going to be playing that role? Right. So we'll... He has been named, but it's like, well, you asked the question about Jared. What does that mean? And is there a team at the State Department, as there has always been for every administration of both parties, including presidents, both Bushes, supporting him with a plan to get negotiations back on track? I hope that he has a team and that he's working with these folks with a plan. I hope.
So your argument is that, you know, the State Department needs to be staffed. This needs to be led more from a State Department.
Not necessarily led from the State Department. Look, I worked in...
Because there's no secret that Obama...
centralized a lot of foreign policy. The president's president has his people around him. And I actually don't begrudge people that. My bigger, broader point is naming people to positions does not equal plans. And I want to see evidence that there is a plan in place if they're going to move on Middle East peace.
What do we think about his itinerary for his upcoming trip?
Well, it makes total sense.
Yeah, it's a meeting with the top three religions. You're going to Saudi Arabia, home of Mecca. You're meeting at the Vatican, and you're going to Israel. So I think it's good, and we'll see what comes of this trip. Again, it's, you know, getting the Pope to weigh in on this peace process to...
The Pope's going to have some tough words for him, I think, on some issues, too, like immigration and refugees.
Right.
I suspect. Right. And the Saudi Arabia part is interesting to me, too, because for Middle East watchers, he had one of the things I think they've done differently than the Trump administration is try and become closer to Saudi Arabia. You see it in their rhetoric on Yemen, I think, and on some other issues. But that is not a surprising stop on the first trip. But I think that is one relationship they are certainly trying to cultivate.
Well, and it comes back to Iran again, right? And so the Iranian elections are on May 19th. It seems like not much has really been said about that. I think everyone's kind of holding their powder dry. You know, we can't really forget what happened in 2009 as well, when the Obama administration faced a lot of criticism for not supporting the Green Revolution, which is a question for you. I mean, that question comes up all the time. Why didn't they support it?
And should Trump support one?
Right. So, and this is an interesting, right, taking it to the Trump administration, I will very briefly touch on 2009. But, you know, one of the recommendations I've tried to give to Trump administration officials, at least publicly, if they ever watch me on Fox, is, which there's a good bet, probably sometimes they do, is with some of the hardline rhetoric here in the U.S., you are unintentionally you're empowering people in Iran that you probably don't want to empower. They're hardliners. And so if you actually, and they are not a monolith, right? I mean, Rouhani is not a liberal or a moderate, but he is different in what policies he would pursue than someone like Raisi, one of the other candidates. So if you take this tougher, harder line on Iran, you may end up empowering the people you actually don't want to empower. I think he should stay out of it. I think the U.S. should stay out of Iranian politics as much as we possibly can. In 2009, we heard a lot from Iranian dissidents and folks that were protesting the election that the worst thing we could do to help them was to get involved and look like we were supporting them. That's a death sentence for an Iranian political movement, having the backing of the great Satan, right? I mean, that's so
maybe we can ask Russia to interfere.
Is that a recommendation to the Trump administration?
I don't know. Maybe, who would they prefer as a candidate?
I think that the Iranians...
Hardliner or Rouhani?
Who would the Russians... I mean, the Russians, I will say, despite all of their nasty activity in a lot of places, during the Iran nuclear negotiations, they were incredibly tough on the Iranians. And given their extensive knowledge of nuclear technology, didn't let them get away with a whole lot. You know, I don't know who the Russians would prefer. I think it's a good U.S. policy not to pick winners and losers in other political systems. I don't know. As a general matter.
Right.
I don't trust polls here. I'm not going to trust polls in Iran. You know, this is...
So the one place we haven't touched on, and there's been some news about it today, is Afghanistan. And I know Michael had some views about Afghanistan.
Well, this is the Middle East and Southwest Asia. I mean, so today we're hearing a surge component being floated by the administration, an additional 3,000 U.S. troops out of the 82nd Airborne Division. And it's focused on the ISIS fight. So there's a new focus in Afghanistan on ISIS, mm-hmm. and the resurgence of ISIS, not the resurgence, but basically ISIS rolling into places like Libya and Afghanistan to compensate for the loss of territory in Iraq and Syria, and what we're going to do about that. The thinking is that the Taliban is anti-ISIS. Absent the threat of U.S. forces, they fight each other. When there are U.S. forces, I've seen insurgent groups that are opposed to each other actually coalesce
and fight us
until we're not there, and they fight each other. So we have to call Russia on its support for the Taliban, providing lethal aid to the Taliban, because they're not saying only use this lethal aid against ISIS when the Taliban is still attacking American forces. And ISIS is now able to conduct car bomb attacks in Kabul. So there needs to be a focus on Afghanistan. I think the reason there's a new focus by McMaster and Mattis is they were there in the beginning. You worked with Mattis or McMaster in that capacity. They were there in the beginning, and they saw where we could have done things differently and actually prevented this from being a 15-year war or 16-year war now. And the thing is, you know, if this surge is different, and this is one key takeaway that I've seen from the Trump administration. You can announce a surge, but don't announce a withdrawal date. It's ineffective. If you tell a very patient enemy you're going to surge with 15,000 troops, but you're going to leave in a year, the patient enemy waits you out, and then they do something. So we got to get away from end dates. I think 3,000 is too low, but if it's specifically focused on ISIS in Nangarhar province, where the Moab was dropped, then that's a good thing. One thing that I've seen also is the delay of reporting the death of an ISIS leader. Under the Obama administration, and Osama bin Laden's death, of course, it's a different death because we wanted him dead and it was good for the nation, was reported 4 hours after his death, basically silencing the intel community's ability to intercept al-Qaeda cells talking about the death of their leader. That would have resulted in a lot of follow-on intel and a lot of raids. With Abu Sayyaf, remember the CFO in Syria that was the number four guy in ISIS about a year and a half ago when we killed him in the raid? We announced that death 4 hours afterwards. And what happens is everybody throws their cell phones away and everybody goes to the mattresses. What I've noticed with the Trump administration is they're announcing things 3 weeks after the death. They're announcing things a week after the death. And that allows the intelligence community, especially the CIA and NSA, to go after the network. Let the network tell you someone's dead so that you can exploit it instead of telling the network someone's dead and everybody throws their phones away and changes locations. And I think that's a key thing, and I'd like that.
So I think I was CIA spokesperson during the bin Laden raid and did a lot of the public piece of this. The challenge, I mean, that was such a unique
case. It's a different
case. In part because you had people standing outside the compound taking cell phone videos. I mean, the CIA and the military are grappling now with how you do these things where you tell the world that we've had a success when in 10 minutes there could be lots of photos, some of them fake, some of them doctored. We saw all the fake bin Laden death photos. I mean, in part, it's a tough balance because you don't want a bunch of false information. And you know, the SST we got out of the bin Laden compound, just the stuff we were able to collect was of enormous intelligence value. So it is a tough balance, and I grant you that it's a question we should keep asking ourselves. On Afghanistan, I would ask both of you, to what end? What is our fundamental national interest in Afghanistan? And I don't know that I have the answer to this, but after the notion that next year kids born after 9/11 can enlist and fight in this war is stunning to me. And if I can't articulate clearly what should be the national interest there, and then what resources should we put towards that? When we got it, was it really the decimation of al-Qaeda there? That was certainly a core interest. Is it destroying the Taliban? I don't think that will ever happen. So what does that look like? Is it making sure there's a functioning government? I mean, all of these things have been part of the conversation for the last 16 years. And I would love for both of you to, what do you think the Trump administration should make the core interest, and then a policy should flow from there? But what is that?
One of the things that I think is important, and I hope to see more of, is the Trump administration learning from the mistakes of previous administrations. So, Michael, you mentioned an important one, which was the Obama administration set a troop withdrawal deadline for Afghanistan, which was a huge mistake. And the Trump administration has hopefully learned from that. The Obama administration also followed a troop withdrawal deadline for Iraq, which was actually set under the Bush administration. And I hope the Trump administration will learn from that as well. With respect to Afghanistan, the end game is very difficult to come up with because there's not a lot of hope for Afghanistan to be fully secure and to be economically viable on its own, which really requires a long-term presence by the U.S. and by the coalition. however unsettling that is to the American people. And I think the Trump administration is beginning to realize that. The increase in troops is a recognition of that. We have a pretty good partner in Ashraf Ghani, mm-hmm. But he's going to need our support to survive. And I think that's what where the Trump administration is headed.
I think we're going to open questions now.
Just one quick thing. Anybody who's ever played the game of Risk knows you cannot control Afghanistan. There's no way to stay on it. So
it's funny. Risk was also on my bingo card.
And then we'll open it to questions. Get the gentleman here in front, white.
White.
Oh, this gentleman right here.
General Kimmett.
There's a mic coming. Not that you need it, but
first of all, let me go back to the old premise that politics stops at the water's edge. So let's talk about foreign policy. I didn't hear a lot of foreign policy today. I heard a lot of anecdotal evidence about Middle East issues. So let's talk about the entire foreign policy, which I'm trying to grapple with at this point. Number one, well, reflect on these.
Can you identify yourself, if you don't mind?
Yeah, I'm Mark Kim, and I used to be uniformed military, DOD, and State Department. So I've got a little bit of association with all of this. Tell me what these five incidents mean as Trump foreign policy. Pushback on North Korea with regards to their missile program. Telling the Russians that we're going to outspend you if you increase your nuclear arsenal. Pushback on Iran, the famous red line that was drawn by Flynn. The attack on Syria. I mean, it would appear to me that there's some cohesion to this strategy that goes beyond sort of these. This is not a straw payment with a bunch of little dots. Tell me what this overall strategy means in terms of foreign policy on three levels. Number one, tell me what it means from a defense point of view. Number two, has the Department of Defense taken over the role of foreign policy in this country? And number three, in terms of those other functions of foreign policy, diplomacy and development, what's going on there?
I'll do the DOD part and pass it to you. So the one thing that we've advised the Trump administration through some of my colleagues, and I had a chance to brief the transition team, was, and you can see this with what McMaster and Mattis is doing, is their main emphasis is defeat ISIS and curb Iranian influence in the Middle East. Put the war against ISIS back under DOD as opposed to State Department like it was in the Obama administration. And to start doing those things. Now, whether or not the 59 cruise missile attack in Syria is tied to that, it still sends a message that things are changing, that this is an unpredictable administration, in some cases that works, in some cases it doesn't. But the overarching DOD strategy for the Middle East, North Africa, Southwest Asia is defeat ISIS and curb Iranian influence. And then you can talk to the State Department.
So from a foreign policy perspective, when it comes to diplomacy, it was sort of what I got at earlier. Personnel is policy in my mind, as are budgets, quite frankly. And the things you mentioned are all sort of flashes in the pan. And I'm not saying that negatively. I don't mean to say that negatively. But General Flynn walked out and drew a red line. But what did that mean? If you're sitting at the State Department and you say, okay, now I have to implement a new policy, it's not clear what the second, third, fourth, fifth, what that means from a policy perspective. I mean, if I had been sitting at the State Department, I would have heard that. Maybe they did tell them, here's what that means from a diplomatic perspective. Go back to the Iranians and say X, Y, Z. Maybe they did. I just haven't seen that. So all of those things you mentioned, I think, are designed. This is an administration that pays an enormous amount of attention to how things play publicly. I mean, the president watches a lot of media. He sees how things play out in the press and on Twitter more than I think other administrations probably have. And so all of those are designed to send messages. My point in the diplomatic conversation we had earlier was, I agree with some of those messages. Some I don't, some I do. My question, and I haven't seen evidence publicly yet, is beneath those messages, are there people in the diplomatic corps working on them? But is there, from a diplomatic perspective, is there a document that says, okay, we threw a warning shot at North Korea? Is there a diplomatic strategy on a couple pieces of paper that says, here's how we're going to try and get back to five-party or whatever kind of negotiations? Here are the specific levers we're pushing with China. Here's what specifically we would need out of North Korea. I mean, I have a lot of suggestions for all of that. But that isn't where they've been focused, at least publicly, in talking about foreign policy. And it leads me to worry that there's not an emphasis on diplomacy as a detailed tool or tactic, but more as a way to publicly send signals to other countries that were different than the Obama administration.
General Kimmett, I think your question is, what is this president's foreign policy? And that's an important question because it helps us figure out what, for us and our allies, figure out what is the president going to do next so that we have some certainty and understanding and predictive ability for what the future holds. And you mentioned these five things and asked us to connect the dots. I personally cannot connect the dots. I cannot see any consistency to them. And then if you compare it to what this president has said his foreign policy will be, which is America first, which is pull back from the world, which is be less involved, which is to do less nation building, it doesn't make sense at all because those things suggest that we're going to be more involved. There is one thing that sort of is consistent, which he seems to be against proliferation, against the use of chemical weapons. Okay, that makes sense, but that's not really consistent with an America first policy. My own personal view is, like Michael said, there are a couple things that we know this administration should be doing, and it's a continuation of what the Obama administration was focusing on, which is to fight ISIS and to defeat ISIS. I think it should also be to stop the creation of failed states and to support countries that are on their way to being failed states so that they don't become failed states, because if they do, they will be places that are hospitable to groups like ISIS. So it's sort of a sub-objective to fighting ISIS and defeating ISIS. But what else this president can do and intends to do, I'm not sure. If you look at Iraq and you look at Syria, you could come up with some consistent planning for what you want the future to look like. I personally think it's going to require acknowledging that Iraq is never going to go back together as one country, and to decentralizing in Iraq, decentralizing resources, decentralizing security. And the longer we take to get to that, the more likely it is that Iraq will break up into separate countries. I think you could say that might be the same for Syria, that Syria needs a political solution that will also require decentralization and greater representation for the different groups, ethnicities, and sectarian groups in Syria. But I don't see that type of deep thinking in terms of foreign policy coming out of this administration yet.
And the first 100 days haven't given us a lot of hopeful hints, I think.
And that goes back to the question I asked earlier, is how different is Trump's foreign policy to Obama's so far? The gentleman next to you, go down the front row. That's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Rahim Rashidi from Kurdistan TV. In your opinion, what are differences between Obama and Trump administration for the Kurds? Thank you.
So you have.
Well, I mean, I'm very involved with the Kurds. I mean, full disclosure, with the Kurds and the Kurdistan Regional Government, and have worked with them for a long time and worked with them and the struggles that they face. I'm not sure I see a difference yet in the Trump administration's view or policy towards the Kurds from the Obama administration. It's not discernible in my view. I think that the Kurds would welcome a greater engagement by the U.S. and a much larger presence by the U.S. in Iraq, and it seems like we're going that way, but it's not clear yet.
Let's branch out to someone in the back. The lady, Sand. I'll get to you.
Sorry. Ann Pierce, author and commentator. I want to ask a question about how best to pressure Assad to go, because I don't agree that the Obama administration's policy was that Assad must go. I think both before and after the red line, both before and after Obama made that muted suggestion that Assad should go, there was a turning down of pretty much every positive humanitarian and strategic proposal, from Sarkozy's recommendation of a humanitarian corridor to multiple recommendations for safe zones and arming rebels and all that sort of thing. So, and then most of all, going along with one Russian plan after another, which often had the effect of buying Assad time and cover just when time was running out. The Russian plans were really something that Obama tended to go along with. So when I wanted to ask Michael Prejant, when you're talking about our trying to create some balance with all these zones being set up by Iran and Turkey and Russia, and you say that we should be actively setting up our own zones in one way or another, how does that fit in with the idea that Assad must go? And how, under such a divided kind of strategy, would you have an overarching strategy that this butcher, you know, needs to leave?
I think the window's closing. I think Putin lost a lot of leverage after the 59 cruise missile strike on Assad following the chemical attack. That was a time to engage that Assad must go. The good thing about Putin, Erdogan, and Trump is they're all transactional presidents. Putin was weakened after this strike, but has now rebounded, unfortunately, with the establishment of these safe zones and by moving Assad's air force to these bases. So again, like I said before, everything that the Russians and the Iranians have done so far has been based on the calculation that the U.S. would do nothing about it. And Trump changed that with his strike, but we're losing, the windows of opportunity is closing, and where Putin was weak 3 weeks ago, I don't think he's as weak now. That's my thought on that.
Gentlemen, the blue suit up here.
Wait, and then you, sir.
My name is Paul Johnson. I'm a Persianist living here in Washington, D.C. And many years ago, in the early 70s, I had the wonderful opportunity to live in Iran and study Persian at the University of Tehran and also teach at our USIS language school, which was two blocks away from the university. The building's still there. The Iranians do teach there, but it's different. Now, one weekend or one term in October, and I think it was during Ramadan in 73, I had a student sitting in the back of the room. He would sit there and glare at me and never responded in class. And then one night when I came to class, the director, Iranian director of the institute, said, "Well, you can't go into that room anymore because it was bombed." All right. Bombs occurred. Everything worked out fine. I came back to the United States and did some degrees here, but about 3 years ago, they had a Mujahideen-e-Khalq meeting in Georgetown. They had people from the Mujahideen-e-Khalq at the corner of, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin Avenue, in front of where the clock is. I was standing there looking at them, and they were chanting in Persian. And lo and behold, who's standing next to me? The person who bombed my class.
Did you say hello?
Okay. So we talked, and I told him, well, you know, I want you to come on. Okay, I'll forget it. I want you to comment on what I'm saying. My point is that we were talking there. Okay.
Sir, you're telling a story.
Fine. Several months ago, I was watching television, and now, because Mujahideen-e-Khalq means the people's Mujahideen, everybody feels that the people's Mujahideen is wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's not like the Hezbollah, which, of course, means the same thing. I saw exactly the same person sitting in Congress behind the people who were talking in Congress in a official televised session. The same person. We have been infiltrated. And that's the kind of thing that happens because we do not know the history of the country. Okay, thank you very much. And if you have any comments about this, please ask.
The MEK has a PR problem they deal with every day. You're not the only person who remembers who they are, and they're dealing with it every day. These attacks happened in 72, like you said. They have a PR issue that they're working on. And they're
a lot of money to help fix it.
All right. We promised this gentleman a question here in the front.
Thank you. My name is Radwan Masmoudi. I'm president of the Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. My question is, what's after ISIS? I can see that the goal is to get rid of ISIS, and I think militarily we are more than capable of getting rid of ISIS. But we haven't really solved the underlying problems that are causing groups like ISIS to grow in the Arab world, which is lack of opportunity, which is corrupt and oppressive regimes that we now seem to be going back to the old policy of supporting those regimes in the name of stability, and forgetting that those regimes that are corrupt and oppressive are the reasons that millions or thousands at least of young people are turning to extremism. So what about the ideals of democracy and human rights and supporting and standing up for those values in order to really defeat extremism? You know, I don't think authoritarian regimes are the solution.
So I'll just say something about this, and I'm sure you have thoughts too. You're absolutely right. And that's why the lopsided focus, I would argue, in the current administration on military hardware versus diplomacy or development or aid programs that support human rights or democratization groups. It's much harder work to do, as you know, but you can make so much progress for so much less money than you can building a bomb.
The State Department's budget has been revised. I've read in the press again.
Can you give him a yellow card?
Yeah, so, I mean, Rex Tillerson has been on the record. He and his advisors have been on the record calling the State Department the Titanic, saying it's sinking and they're going to significantly cut personnel, including by some forced retirements. And it may not be cut by 33%, but he supports that number in general over a period of time, not over a year. So yes, and I think Bob Corker and others will come to our rescue and make sure the budget isn't slashed as much, but it will be cut. And it's not just a budget, it's where you put the resources. I mean, just a personal point of reference for a second, when I, as an Obama administration official, said, we're going to kill a lot of terrorists, but in the long term, we have to address conditions like jobs and opportunity. I became an internet meme that said, dumb blonde says, ISIS just needs jobs and they'll stop killing us. And not just a meme on the internet, but something Republican members of Congress asked my boss about in a hearing. So when the conversation about how you fight terrorism in the long term here at home politically becomes so ridiculous, and not based on what experts from people like you to military commanders say, yeah, we can kill them and we're going to keep killing them, but in the long term, how do you create opportunities so young men and women don't want to strap bombs to themselves? That takes a long-term commitment from USAID, from the State Department, from our partner countries, building up partner capacity where they are trying to make inroads towards democracy, places like Tunisia. There are some examples where this is sort of working. That is a recommendation I would scream from the rooftops to the Trump administration, and people like you making that case is so important for this effort.
So I would just add, there are always going to be groups like ISIS that are appealing to young, disaffected, disenfranchised, economically oppressed youth. But So you mentioned some of those causes. They're innumerable, but you mentioned some of them. But I also look at this from a slightly different angle, which is what led the local populations to support and tolerate ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And in this case, these are the Sunni populations. And some of the things that led to that are mistakes that were made that we can correct and have to correct. And if you take Iraq, for instance, it was the mistake of letting Prime Minister Maliki run the Baghdad government as a sectarian government that only provided support and resources to the Shiite community, and that tried to minimize the importance and the legitimacy and the capability of Sunni leaders in Iraq. He ran out every capable Sunni leader from Baghdad and ultimately left the Sunni areas in Iraq so disenfranchised, oppressed, and with the view that the government of Baghdad did not support them, did not listen to them, and did not represent them, such that when ISIS came along, they were at least willing to look the other way and let them be there, and in many cases, and in other cases, join them and support them. And you could say the same about Syria, the lack of support for the Sunni opposition in Syria and the lack of ability of the Sunni opposition to coalesce the support that it needed to oppose Assad also led to some Sunni populations in Syria looking the other way when ISIS came in town, or even looking to ISIS as their saviors. We are working on correcting those, and we need to focus on those things.
We went over. If you're happy to stay, we'll take a question.
Maybe a couple more. We could talk about this all day, as you can probably tell.
This is a courtesy to our audience.
Yes. We won't be offended if you leave.
I'm Penny Starr with Breitbart News. And you were talking about the staffing at the State Department, which interests me, because while you're saying they need to get people in there, there's also criticism about Obama holdovers, about there being a lot of acting people at the State Department in particular. And interestingly, I know that on the campaign trail, or even past then, Trump has said he wasn't going to have a special envoy on climate change, and yet there is the same one that worked, I think, with you. Is that it's Tripp?
Yeah, no, our special envoy left, but
just more.
But it says that he was appointed by Obama, though.
I don't know who that is.
You don't know who that is?
No.
Anyway, there.
I mean, I can look at it, but I don't.
I wondered what that role is playing and what.
Yeah, well, so I don't know about that specific person. I'm happy to look into it. The bigger question is when. Yes, these positions exist. And so when there's not an appointee made by the administration, someone acts in an acting capacity. Generally at the State Department, that is a career foreign service officer. So it's a nonpartisan career person who works for both Democrats and Republicans. That's generally how it works. But which is interesting, because one of the things President Trump was very clear about is that he wants his people in place, and I don't begrudge him that. So ironically, by not appointing people, you're getting career folks that are very competent, and I don't want to discount their competency at all. But if he wants people in there putting his own views forward, he needs to send some staffing suggestions. And, you know, there was early criticism of Congress for not, you know, now they've approved everyone that's been nominated. I mean, they're waiting for nominations to come to them, almost everyone. I think some folks are still waiting. But, yeah, I mean, the State Department is someone needs to be the Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs. If the Trump administration doesn't appoint someone, a career Foreign Service officer will very capably act in that role. But when they're talking to a foreign government, they don't carry the same weight always of representing the president. And for a president who has very, I think, specific and unique views on foreign policy, that personal representation really matters, I think, to our partners, I think. You're in charge. We've lost a panel member, so. No, I'm just kidding. It's okay. I'm just teasing you.
You don't need me.
So I just want to bring up the visit of the next week of President Erdogan. I think you didn't mention that. I think in Syria, Syria you have Iran as a problem. In Syria, you have Turkey also as a problem. How do you think the role of Turkey mm-hmm. is really, you know, is as a something that is going to help that, let's say there is a policy, a policy for Syria. How much is Turkey really helping or hurting that policy in Syria for the Trump administration?
So I'm going to say something very quickly, but then I want you to answer this because you know this better than I do. The relationship with Erdogan is fascinating because, yes, he's a NATO ally, but they also have enormous governance and human rights problems at home. And one fundamental underlying principle of Trump foreign policy appears to be respect for very strong leaders, some would call them strong men, and a less focus on human rights. And Erdogan is the classic example when he congratulated him after that election for basically consolidating power. That is something new in American foreign policy. But you talk about the specifics here in Syria.
Well, first of all, I completely agree with what you just said. It's just stupefying that President Trump would have congratulated Erdogan on that accomplishment, on changing the constitution and putting himself in power for another 12 years. And especially given all the other changes that have happened in Turkey, the crackdown on journalists and on media and on any opposition. I'm very concerned about what's happening with Turkey. I'm worried that President Trump is not going to have the right agenda for the visit with Erdogan, which I believe should be an agenda in which he is counseling Erdogan on the things that he needs to do to make Turkey more democratic. I'm also worried about the new alliance between Turkey and Russia and perhaps even Assad with respect to Turkey, to Syria. Certainly Turkey has not been always a positive force in Syria. It did not control the flow of foreign fighters to Syria for ISIS the way it should have. It has improved its record on that some, but I'm still not convinced that it's fully dedicated to preventing support for ISIS going through the Turkey. And I worry about what Turkey's true motives are in Syria and Iraq, given its position with respect to the Kurds.
Thank you. My comment, I'd like your input in, is I sense that perhaps we're over sort of analyzing what his policies are, because one, it just, in fairness, he's still sort of in the first bottom of the first inning, and his policies are evolving from his campaign rhetoric, and he's learning on the job, if you will. But I think it's still, it's somewhat consistent in, there is not going to be no ideological consistency. It's a more pragmatic approach to pursuing Americans' interest, and in when there is a dichotomy between pursuing our interest of, for instance, solving problems in Turkey, Syria, in Iraq, versus values such as human interest, he's going to side and what it takes to solve the problem, and that, you know, supporting Turkey or whatever it takes to get the problem done. To me, that's how I read everything that's going on.
Well, we probably also, despite the name of the panel, agree that 100 days is not a lot of time, and it's this sort of media-driven deadline. So you're right. We have a long way to go, and I think that he is a president who didn't come in with a lot of foreign policy experience and is learning, and I think that's inevitable and a good thing. Yeah?
Just one thing about the surge real quick.
It just popped into his head.
It did.
I would love to know how these all...
Only because we said 100 days, right? So, so Trump's announcing a surge in Afghanistan the first 110 days. I thought I turned this on. Wrong song, sorry.
Just yell.
All right, so Trump announced a surge in Afghanistan the first 100 days. Remember, Bush announced his surge in 2007. Only had a year to go before Obama took over, right? Yeah. So this, it's good to get a surge in early when you have 4 years to make sure that it actually changes momentum on the battlefield, where Bush lost that opportunity because he implemented it his basically last year.
Too late. President. But I'm going to agree with you that I agree how you described what I think the Trump administration's focus on is on. The question I would pose to you and to others is something that I think John McCain was trying to get at in his op-ed. There are times when interests and values conflict and you have to prioritize. And I agree, and I think that particularly my party, when we argue they don't ever, is putting our head in the sand. So I agree with you. I think the broader point Senator McCain was trying to make, and we sort of got at it in this question about how long-term you fight radicalization, is they're not always mutually exclusive, and that in fact they can be mutually reinforcing. And to ignore, or seemingly, at least based on what Secretary Tillerson has said, to fundamentally put aside human rights as not part of the conversation, I think hurts the interest, will in the medium and long term hurt the interest side as well. That's a broader point, but I think you're absolutely right about how they would describe their foreign policy and how it looks now. I think you're completely on point. Do you have anything to add? Is that it? Are we done?
We're going to wrap.
Okay. Thank you all
for
coming.
Thank you so much. Huh?